Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Survive by Vera Nazarian, narrated by Sophia Willingham. Chapter 1. August 2048. Green Mar Yon 9771. Today is the day everything changes. What have I done? I won. I used my Logos power voice to raise the Atlantis Grail Monument, but instead I blasted open an ancient buried secret. And now I stand in the largest arena in the city of Poseidon, amid the stadium wreckage that I've caused, held in the arms of my beloved Aeson, while the nose section of an ancient starship juts forth from the broken ground. The shocked spectator crowds have grown momentarily quiet. They're full of confusion, still under the influence of the Imperial compelling voice. I, on the other hand, have not been compelled, but I have been stopped and silenced by the enormity of the consequences of my actions. The stunning things that Aeson Cassiope, my Imperial bridegroom, has just told me are ringing violently in my head. Unbelievable, impossible things implicating his father, the Imperator, my future father-in-law, in a dark plot, an intricate scheme presumably to prevent an alien invasion, although the grim details and causes have yet to be unraveled. That includes Aeson's father sending the deadly asteroid on a collision course to destroy Earth a few months from now. The Imperator is responsible for so much. But then, so am I. Because of my actions, the ancient Ark ship that had been lying dormant for thousands of years, buried underground, has been activated somehow. And now they will come. They, the mysterious ancient alien enemy of both Earth and Atlantis. After all that's happened today and over the past 4 weeks, the violent insanity of the games, the relentless uncertainty of my every living moment, this knowledge comes as a heavy blow. I feel as if I've been punched in the gut.
My God, I've caused all this,
I continue to whisper, even as Aeson tightens his embrace and stares into my eyes with loving force.
I caused this. If, as you say, they can track this ship, they will come because of what I did.
Let them come, he repeats fiercely, a hard smile on his lips. Together we'll handle them, Imam Revu. Look at me. Do you hear?
Yes, I nod, but the word comes out without conviction. I glance yet again in the direction of the Imperial box among the audience tiers, where Rumhutat Cassiope, the Archaon Imperator of Atlantida, stands looking at me like a dragon. Our gazes meet. Or maybe he just never stopped watching me.
Gwen.
Aeson's strong fingers dig into my shoulders, anchoring me, forcing me to turn back to him.
It's over. We must go.
I part my lips just to say something, not even sure what, because I'm trapped in the bizarre moment that somehow must not end, because whatever comes next will be impossible. What have I done? The priest of the Grail called it blasphemy. What does it mean? What happens now? I glance behind me at the dais in the center of the arena, where the other champions and runners-up remain standing before the judges. Hedge, Kateb, Bree, Kokai, Leetana, Rurim, Uko, all in brightly lit uniforms that indicate champion status. Chihar, Lolu, and two others, their fates as champions or runners-up are as yet unresolved. Finally, Sophia and Fauzi, my two direct competitors in the vocalist category, who lost by virtue of the fact that I won. They're all staring at me with shock and fear and other hard-to-describe, complicated expressions. Bree Walton, in particular, has a stunned look on her face, and the vocalist judge, the stern woman who assigned our category tiebreaker task, she is frozen with incredulity
as she too fixes her attention on me. What must they all think? And what about the thousands of people in the audience who have just witnessed an impossible miracle, followed by a disaster, all of it perpetrated by me? Do they even understand what's visible in the wreckage around us? The Grail is but a tiny fraction of the upper end of an immense object that's still mostly below ground. In that moment, the Imperator's voice sounds again, breaking me out of my stupefied reverie and adding a level of nervous frenzy to my already racing thoughts. This time, he is not using a compelling power voice, merely ordinary stadium amplification, as he speaks with regained composure. But even unenhanced, the deep, ice-cold sound of his voice slithers and reverberates throughout the expanse.
No, not blasphemy, but the whim of nature. An unfortunate seismic interruption to our celebratory events.
What? My heart begins to pound like crazy, kicking up my blood pressure, thundering in my temples.
It is done. The spectacle is over. For today, the games will conclude and the remaining champions will be honored later. You will now return to your homes, Atlantida.
Saying this, the Imperator turns his back to the stadium and proceeds to leave the Imperial box, followed by his retinue of Imperial guards. He does not look at me again. Immediately, the crowds surge, and the audience noise level rises as thousands of shocked people are given permission to come alive again and move. An actual earthquake? Is that the official spin of what took place? Holy crap! Seeing him go, just like that, my mind goes spinning also. Seriously, what just happened? What does it mean? Did he just dismiss the effect of my actions completely? What supreme imperial disdain! How can he disregard me in the face of recent events? Or is he choosing to conceal his turmoil under a public mask while simply escaping an unbearable reality? This is crazy. A whole stadium of people witnessed me use a voice command to raise the Atlantis Grail and the resulting mess that followed. Surely at least some of them will question what happened, not merely fall for the ridiculous earthquake explanation. Not to mention the Imperator had addressed me directly, told me to stop, and said that I won, which acknowledges the role of my actions. Will the rest of the officials go along with this? As if on cue, the priest of the Grail raises his hands and echoes the imperial words in a ceremonial tone of voice. By the firm sound of it, he's recovered also and embraced an appropriate extended interpretation.
The imperial sovereign has spoken. The stadion is structurally unsafe. There has been an earthquake. There may be aftershocks. Leave at once, but proceed in orderly fashion.
At this point, it's redundant. Everyone is already streaming toward the exits. But the priest must feel it's his duty to do something, so he continues to intone needless instructions, even as other games officials remain silent. Meanwhile, my mind is stuck. There are no words.
Come.
Aeson's expression is intense and grim as he grips my hand, and this time I don't protest, as we hurry toward the nearest exit. I breathe hard and try not to stumble over cracks and broken ground beneath my feet while I walk quickly alongside him. In moments, the Crown Prince's own guards join and surround us. I look back fleetingly to see that the people on the dais are leaving also, my friends and members of Team Lark, many of them continuing to stare in my wake, but there's no time to linger. Some part of me is aware of Hell's sun glare, shining fiercely over the strange, gleaming grail portion of the nose section of the huge buried ship, turning it to golden fire. It blazes over the turmoil of moving humanity that now fills the audience seating tiers where everything is precarious, structurally unsound. People rush to the exits past grand divine statues of heroes that now lean, dangerously unbalanced. Also, I might be hallucinating this, but somehow I hear,
From deep below ground and seemingly from all around, a barely perceptible auditory emanation. A very low humming sound. So low that it's almost out of human hearing range. Indeed, maybe I'm only feeling it as vibrations along my skin. But it's undeniable. A constant metallic din that resonates deep into the bowels of Atlantean hell. It's as if an immense subterranean thing of metal is singing. Aeson! I try to catch my breath and ignore the faint, impossible metallic noise underfoot. Did you hear what they said? What now? Of course he heard. What a stupid thing to utter. He glances at me with visceral intensity. The infinite burden contained in his gaze disturbs me somehow. I'm not even sure why. He then quickly looks around before returning his attention to me.
First, we're going to find your sister and brother.
Oh, Lord, yes, I exclaim, stunned at myself for momentarily forgetting, not thinking of my siblings, my family. What's wrong with me? Gracie must be going insane, and Gordy too. Just as I say it, I see them, there, near the arena exit directly ahead, one of several that escaped damage when the ground buckled underneath. There's Gracie, and next to her is my brother Gordy, and behind them a few other familiar faces. Is that LaRonda and Dawn, waving and motioning to us? Owala, maybe? Zelio and Keruvat? Who else? We move toward them, and they meet us at the doors leading inside the stadium building. In that first wild moment when we come together, I have eyes only for my two younger siblings, and no one else matters. Gracie, I cry with a surge of warmth and relief, shutting off everything else in my mind, pushing worry back for now. My sister has a weird deer-in-the-headlights look when she first sees me, and then she makes a stifled noise and rushes into my arms.
Gracie, oh sweetie! Gordy, come here! It's okay! Everything is okay!
I mumble and laugh and cry, continuing to hold Gracie and at the same time pull my brother into a three-way embrace with my other hand. I am crushing them both hard, not coming apart for long, breathless moments.
I survived it! We did it! I exclaim. It's okay now. It's over. Doesn't matter what or how.
Gracie's face is hidden, pressed hard against my chest, and she is now shaking with quiet sobs, and Gordy has a strange, lost look on his face as he looks at me. I can't imagine what they must think. They must be as shocked as everyone by what just happened, by what I, of all people, have done.
Oh, honey, it's okay.
I smile, smoothing dirty blonde tendrils of Gracie's hair plastered to her forehead and wet cheeks, tendrils that have escaped her otherwise tight ponytail. It's the little details. I find I can notice them now, make time for them at long last. I look up momentarily and see Aeson watching us, watching me, with an indescribable look of compassion. Gracie shows me her face at last, straightens and moves back a bit, sniffling and wiping her nose with the back of her hand. She then forcibly stops crying, swallows, and says in a hoarse voice,
"Gwen, Mom is gone."
Cold. Cold emptiness strikes me a sudden blow that I never see coming. I don't quite understand it. What? I look at Gracie, at the oh-so-familiar shape of her face, her sticky cheeks and forehead, with its plastered tendrils of hair, her smudged eyes.
What did you say?
But Gracie is bawling now, and her face has collapsed into a red, twisted mess. Punched in the gut with cold.
Gracie!
My voice is hard and cutting.
It's Mom,
Gordy speaks in an alien voice.
She is...
No, I say, and my voice is a knife. At the same time, I'm very, very calm. Everything narrows into focus. Everything is very strong and sharp and bright. I am looking at Gordy, and it's as if all of this past year, all the growing up on his part, didn't happen. Once again, he's just a little boy with smudged glasses, dumbfounded and helpless. He blinks and opens his mouth and blinks again.
"We talked with Dad and George. They're on the Ark ship now and...
"And what?" I interrupt his useless mumble. "What?"
"I'm sorry. So sorry, Gwen,"
Gracie interrupts in turn, gasping between sobs, and now I turn to her like a compass needle, cold and numb.
"Mom died several days ago. We found out and then..."
Gordy fades off into useless silence. "No," I say again, and then I repeat violently with fury.
"No, no, no!"
I am shaking, ice cold, dry in the back of my throat, perfectly calm and alert. Sharp, sharp focus. Everyone is looking at me, frozen motionless with pity, tragedy, fear. Some of them even stunned at my reaction. Somewhere, with my peripheral vision, I am aware of all of them. My friends and supporters, fellow Earth refugees, Atlantean Ostradaimon surrounding us. But my razor focus is on Gordy and Gracie, because there can be no other way. "When," I start, clenching my hands, clenching all of me, so that I become a stiff, unyielding thing of bone. "Tell me, Gwen." I feel Aeson's gentle touch on my shoulder, but immediately I shake him off. I take a step back so that neither Aeson nor my siblings nor anyone else can touch me. Gracie starts crying again, this time gently and silently, fat tears running down her face, then again sucks in a deep breath to speak.
"It was during Stage 2, when you were inside the pyramid. The third day of Stage 2. Mom, she was gone on that day, but we only found out later, on Day 4, when we got the call from the Ark ship. Dad and George, they were picked up and..."
"And they called immediately," Gordy continues. "It was afternoon, our time, and we were in the audience at the game zone watching you, and we got called back urgently to Foineos Heights. I mean, your fiancé, Aeson, he got a message. It was the only time he left the games, and you, only for this. He took us back himself, and that's when we found out."
"How?" I say. I find that I am incapable of sentences, only short, stupid words.
"How did she die?"
Gracie makes a hard noise, then muffles it.
"She was really sick. It was the advanced cancer. The Earth med stopped working, and the Atlanteans didn't get to her in time. She was already so sick. They didn't even get the chance to take her up to the ship. I mean, they promised they were coming over and over, but she passed away at home. I don't understand what actually happened. I mean, why couldn't they land in a stupid shuttle for 5 minutes and get her up there before she got so sick? Why? They missed her by one damn day!"
Gracie's voice rises, and she puts the back of her hand against her mouth and starts trembling with sobs. I watch my sister weep, and I don't reach out to her. Instead, I am frozen in my own ice-cold, alien place. It's as if I am looking at myself from above, floating outside my own numb, dead body. "That long?" I say, my breath forced with every word as I enunciate in a strange wooden staccato.
"You found out 10 days ago, and no one told me?"
"Gwen, you had to remain focused on the games," Aeson says softly. "I'm so sorry, but we couldn't tell you and risk you losing your concentration."
"How could you?"
I turn to Aeson for the first time. He blinks. His expression is heart-wrenching, and something inside me rips wide open. In that same moment, a tide starts rising in the back of my throat, choking me, and liquid pools in my vision.
"How could you keep this from me? It's my mom! Aeson, you saw me several times after you knew, and you said nothing! And you kept me isolated from my family? Is that why you wouldn't let Gracie and Gordy come see me?"
But it's Gracie who snarls suddenly.
"No, don't! Don't you dare put this on him! I asked him to do it. I was the one. Blame me. I knew I couldn't bear to see you without breaking down, and you know Gordy can't lie at all.
Gordy makes a weird, sad noise and stares at me, shifting his shoulders as if to confirm.
So I asked Asen to make up something, anything, to excuse us not visiting you, Gracie continues. It was awful, all those days of knowing about Mom, of talking to Dad and George and not being able to talk to you and not knowing if you were going to die too in those damn games.
Sorry, G2, we had to stay away. So sorry, Gordy adds painfully. Tough to pretend. It sucked.
Then he clamps up again.
I press my lips together hard, clench my mouth, trying to hold back the quivering, the drowning tide.
It is now an ocean. It surges over my head and finally swallows me. The next few minutes are a mess. I collapse and Asen catches me in his strong arms and half carries me as we walk through the stadium corridor to exit the building complex. People I know walk on all sides of me. I feel Gracie's cold, wet hand clutching mine and Gordy's awkward fingers pressing my shoulder while I shuffle along like an old woman on limp feet. The Astrodaimon whisper discreetly among themselves. Occasional individuals and groups of strangers hurry past us in this network of passages with fresh cracks in the walls and other visible signs of damage. Meanwhile, the hallway lights flicker randomly or go out completely, indicating malfunctions. All of this I notice with one small part of my consciousness, while the rest of me is as broken as the structure around me. My face is wet and my nose is thick with weeping, and I'm barely aware of my own feet moving because of the general anemic weakness that has come over me like a life-leeching blanket. At some point in the low illumination, my white contender uniform suddenly sparks with an energy charge, like static electricity, and then it lights up brightly, vocalist white. It's now glowing belatedly, indicating my formal champion status. Is this the result of Imperial orders? Somewhere the games tech must have been instructed to run the final sequence of my contender uniform program, which makes it official. I won my category in the games of the Atlantis Grail. Gordy makes a small sound as he points at my shining outfit, and the rest of my friends notice, but no one reacts or says anything. They realize that at this moment I don't give a damn.
Only a little more, Gwen. We're almost there, Asen keeps saying as he guides me forward. His hands support me, keeping me upright, because I'm limp and barely functional.
Mom.
We finally emerge outside and reach the competitor parking area for the hover cars, where I vaguely recognize one of Asen's gleaming metallic vehicles, this one a large four-seater, and next to it the usual vehicles of the guards. I am seated next to Gracie in the back, while Asen and Gordy sit in the front, and Asen drives. Asen takes off with a grim expression and a fleeting, intense glance at me. As we rise into the air, I see Don and Chiyoko getting into different hover cars nearby, with Zelio and Arita, and there's Laronda next to Genio and Anu. Their figures shrink and recede, and it all blurs into white sun glare. Gracie continues to clutch my hand and leans into me with her whole body. I can feel how badly she's trembling, but remain silent and numb and let her hold me. We gain altitude, while below the grand structures of the downtown multi-stadium complex gleam with gold and gray metal, the now protruding and displaced Atlantis Grail Monument prominent among them. We join a common air traffic lane and continue moving over the city of Poseidon toward Phoneos Heights, where Asen's estate sits atop a hill, our present home. Soon, the familiar hills and greenery come into view, and we begin the descent. Asen lands the vehicle so it hovers a foot off the ground, and I step out onto the mauve brick surface of the private estate landing area, holding on to Gracie. Immediately, Asen comes around on my other side and gently takes my elbow.
Together we walk up the long, shallow steps to the front door, where a line of estate servants stands waiting for us. Thebet, the old steward, bows deeply before us, before me, as we enter. I take my steps like a decrepit old woman. I nod to the servants, then lower my head and keep it down, so that I can see only the polished hallway floor and not the expressive eyes of all these people. Kind, pitying, in some cases marveling and filled with awe. All of this is directed at me. I hear Aeson give quick instructions to the serving staff, while my brother and sister stand next to me. Meanwhile, sounds of other landing vehicles and voices draw near, coming from outside as more of our friends arrive. I can't deal with any of it. A hard pulse pounds in my temples while waves of heat and cold surge back and forth, coursing alternately through my body. "Aeson," I say loudly, on my last strength. "Please, I need to talk to my father and George. Right now." There's a pause, a quick exchange of glances.
"If you must, Gwen," he says softly, "I will make the call, but..."
"But you're in no condition to talk to them," Gracie interrupts. "Not right now, not when you're barely standing. You need to get in bed and sleep. They're not going anywhere. If they see you like this, you'll only frighten everyone." "I have to speak to them," I cry out in a hoarse, cracking voice, even though I know she's right. And yet, I glance from Gracie to Aeson to Gordy. My tone fades into softness. "They won't care. Dad and George, they would want to speak to me exactly as I am. They understand about the games, right? You told them about me being in the games?" Gracie nods.
"Yeah, they know everything. We told them," Gordy adds.
"And they're worried sick about you." Gracie sniffles and again rubs her face with the back of her hand. I take a shuddering breath. Even more reason to speak to them right damn now. They need to hear directly from me that I'm okay. And I need to hear from them about Mom. Aeson watches me with deep understanding, an unblinking gaze of his lapis lazuli blue eyes. He then reaches for me and squeezes my hand.
"Very well. I will make the call for you. Come with me."
He heads for the media communications room, and I, and my siblings, follow him. The main office workroom, with all the specialized deep space comm equipment, is located on an upper floor of the estate, so we hurry through corridors and up a marble flight of stairs. Aeson holds my hand to help me take each step, but with a burst of adrenaline, I've recovered enough of my strength that I follow him without stumbling, with Gracie and Gordy directly behind us. Inside the room, I am settled on a chair, while Aeson turns on the largest video screen and makes the necessary connection across infinite space to the Ark ship orbiting Earth. Since he's not only the Imperial Crown Prince of Atlantida, but the commander of the International Organization Star Pilot Corps, Aeson has the most sophisticated Atlantean comm tech here at his disposal. It occurs to me he's calling somewhere on the other side of the universe, whatever that means. The universe has no sides. All of this, it is incomprehensible. Focus, focus. Feeble racing thoughts, mind going off on tangents. Stop. I watch the dark screen come alive, unbelievably, after just a few seconds. On the other end is the face of an Atlantean crew member in a gray fleet uniform against a stark background of familiar wall panels inside generic Ark ship quarters. He is a typical Atlantean older teen, with long gilded hair pulled back against a lean, bronze-skinned face with angular lines and pale hazel eyes that seem tired and sleepy. I've never seen him before. The Atlantean crewman on comm duty comes to sharp attention and salutes Aeson.
"Nefero Nyctos, Imperial Lord. Or is it Nefero Dea for you now? Apologies, we didn't expect your call until later."
Aeson barely nods, and his voice becomes cool and commanding.
"We are early. Get me Pilot Nefir Mekei or Pilot Kuoni Enutat. But first we must speak with Charles Lark and George Lark.
Is it night cycle for you now?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?